It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Wednesday he holds the military leadership in Myanmar responsible for the current refugee crisis affecting the country's Rohingya Muslim population.
Someone, if these reports are true, someone is going to be held to account for that. And it's up to the military leadership of Burma to decide what direction do they want to play in the future of Burma. Because we see Burma as an important emerging democracy. But this is a real test. It's a real test of this power-sharing government as to how they're going to deal with this very serious issue.
Rohingyas have crossed the border into neighboring Bangladesh in recent weeks, fleeing a crackdown on their minority community by the Burmese military after Rohingya militants launched deadly attacks on the state security forces. The crackdown, which has resulted in widespread atrocities, has prompted intense international condemnation, though officials in Myanmar continue to deny the crisis even exists. Secretary of State Tillerson has given a rare major foreign policy speech outlining the Trump administration's South Asia policy, reaching out to India to counter China in the Indo-Pacific region. Speaking to a packed auditorium at the Center for Strategic and International Studies Research Center in Washington, D.C., Tillerson looked forward to the next 100 years, he said, of close U.S.-India ties. Tillerson said the U.S. and India are bookends of stability on either side of the globe, noting the nations share a commitment to upholding the rule of law, freedom of navigation, universal values, and trade. He said the Trump administration is determined to dramatically deepen ways for the U.S. and India to work together. This is VOA News. There was relief and pride in the faces of the Kurd fighters as they savored the crushing blow they delivered IS this week, marking the end of 4 months of grueling fighting against the militant for control of the city of Raqqa, the jihadist de facto capital. They raised a flag in Paradise Square, a notorious traffic circle in which the jihadists had staged brutal public executions, including beheadings, leaving severed heads on display for days afterwards. And then the victors donuts spun armored vehicles around in mimicry of how Islamic State militants celebrated their takeover in the city 3 years ago. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Mogadishu and other major Somali cities Wednesday, condemning those behind the massive explosion that killed nearly 300 people and wounded more than 400 others. The Mogadishu protests came in response to a call from the city's mayor for a massive rally to pray for those killed and injured in Saturday's truck bombing, which the government blames on Islamic militant group Al-Shabaab. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley lashed out Wednesday at Iran for what she called a laundry list of bad behavior. She criticized the U.N. Security Council for not holding Tehran accountable. Haley spoke at a monthly council meeting that primarily reviews the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Since arriving at the U.N. in January as President Donald Trump's envoy, she sought to highlight Iranian behavior and that of its regional proxies, Hezbollah and Hamas, during the monthly session. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions on Wednesday declined to discuss his conversations with President Donald Trump concerning the Russia probe and defended the president's immigration agenda and often heated exchanges with lawmakers on Capitol Hill.
Under the administration of both parties, it is well established that a president is entitled to have private, confidential communications with his cabinet officials, his Secretary of State, his Secretary of Defense, his Secretary of Treasury, and certainly his counsel and the Attorney General of the United States who provides counsel, and that such communications are within the core of executive privilege.
And on other topics, Sessions spoke more freely. He vigorously defended President Trump's decision to end a program that has shielded undocumented immigrants brought to the United States as children from deportation in the so-called sanctuary cities. President Trump has denied making insensitive comments to the wife of an American soldier killed in Niger, saying that he is proof a Florida lawmaker fabricated that story, saying the president told the soldier's widow that her husband knew what he signed up for, but the congresswoman said that she has proof that her story's accurate. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's Electoral Commission chief warned politicians against threats to members of the commission.
Let me be very clear that I'm giving a yellow card to all the political leaders in this country. I'll not tolerate the threats on my staff anymore. I'll not tolerate the interference in the commission anymore.
Wafula Chibukata, chairman of Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, a former Liberian warlord, has been found guilty in the United States for lying about his past. A money remittance industry urges support from banks, and the UN Secretary General will visit Central African Republic amid growing communal tensions.
We are determined to ensure that the voices of victims are heard. I will myself be ready to meet with victims and their families in and beyond the Central African Republic. Victims must be at the center of our response.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. We'll tell you about progress in Senegal's healthcare system. UNICEF and others reunite South Sudan children. And Burundi denies revelations in the Panama Papers that President Pierre Nkurunziza diverted funds from Burundi to offshore companies. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The head of Kenya's Electoral Commission Wednesday delivered tough words for the country's politicians a day after one of his commissioners resigned and fled the country. The resignation cast further doubt on whether the commission can organize a credible rerun of the presidential poll next week. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
The chairman of the Kenya's Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, Wafula Chebukati, spoke hours after one of his commissioners resigned and fled to the U.S.
Let me be very clear that I'm giving a yellow card to all the political leaders in this country. I'll not tolerate the threats on my staff anymore. I'll not tolerate the interference in the commission anymore.
Announcing her resignation, Commissioner Roselyn Akombe said she had received death threats, which she found particularly concerning, given that the IEBC's technology manager was found tortured and killed just a week before the polls in August. In her statement, Akombe said that infighting and political pressure have rendered the IEBC incapable of holding a credible rerun of the presidential poll on October 26th. The IEBC chief has also expressed doubts in his remarks Wednesday.
Without critical changes in key secretariat staff, free, fair and credible elections will surely be compromised. I therefore call on the staff who have been adversely mentioned to step aside to allow this project team to function without interference.
Opposition candidate Raila Odinga has pulled out of the rerun, saying the IEBC has failed to remove the individuals responsible for the botched August 8 vote. Opposition protests demanding electoral reforms have turned violent, with three people killed this week. The Supreme Court nullified the results of the August presidential poll, saying the IEBC had not followed the constitution and electoral law. The ruling put Kenya on a tight deadline, with the constitution giving IEBC just 60 days to organize a fresh election. Further adding to tensions, lawmakers from the ruling Jubilee Party pushed through changes to the electoral law in Parliament last week to prioritise manual transmission of results over the electronic system. On Wednesday, IEBC Chief Chebukati called for a meeting with all political leaders.
I cannot move forward with a divided commission. Before the 8th of August election, the commission amicably worked devoid of any divisions. I cannot move forward when presidential candidates refuse to put their personal interests aside and for once serve the country. I took this job to make Kenya better, not to draw it to a crisis.
In a series of tweets Wednesday, President Uhuru Kenyatta called for an extended period of prayer and reconciliation this weekend. He has condemned the Supreme Court's nullification of his win in the August 8th poll, calling the judges crooks, but has said he's ready for the rerun on October 26th. Addressing a rally in the capital Wednesday, Raila Odinga reiterated his decision to boycott and call for a large demonstration on voting day, saying it will be the biggest yet. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations Secretary General said Wednesday that Central African Republic is at a critical moment and that everything must be done to ease growing communal tensions to keep the fragile nation on the right path. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
Antonio Guterres will travel to the Central African Republic next week to meet with the country's leaders and visit the nearly 12,000-member UN peacekeeping mission. The country has been struggling with sometimes deadly intercommunal tensions for the past 5 years between two armed groups, the mostly Muslim Seleka and largely Christian Anti-Balaka. Another serious outbreak of violence between the two groups erupted in May, and Guterres warned that the situation remains very troubling.
Across the country, communal tensions are growing, violence is spreading, and the humanitarian situation is deteriorating.
The numbers of people in need of humanitarian aid is surging, with almost 600,000 internally displaced and more than 500,000 driven to seek refuge in neighboring countries. The violence has been deadly for peacekeepers and aid workers, as well as civilians. Guterres said he has asked the Security Council for an increase in peacekeepers to calm the situation. The UN peacekeeping mission in the CAR has been the epicenter of sexual abuse and exploitation allegations against the United Nations. One mission chief has been fired, and peacekeepers from accused countries have been repatriated. Guterres will be accompanied on his visit by his recently appointed victims' rights advocate.
We are determined to ensure that the voices of victims are heard. I will myself be ready to meet with victims and their families. Heard in and beyond the Central African Republic. Victims must be at the center of our response if we want our zero-tolerance policy to be successful.
Guterres said despite challenges, fragile gains such as the election of a president and government and the establishment of a special criminal court must be preserved and strengthened. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Former Liberian warlord Mohamed Jabate, notoriously known as Jungle Jabba, was found guilty Wednesday by a jury in the U.S. city of Philadelphia for lying about his past as a rebel commander in the Liberian Civil War in the 1990s. Jabate was convicted on immigration fraud and perjury for deceiving U.S. officials about his role during the Liberian Civil War. A total of 20 witnesses brought from Liberia testified that Jabate or his soldiers killed civilians, raped women, and engaged in cannibalism. Jabate admits he fought in the Liberian Civil War, but denies he played any role in committing atrocities. In fact, his lawyer said prosecutors had been hoodwinked by the witnesses. On the line from Philadelphia is Liberian journalist Titi Gibro, who has been covering the trial. Good morning, Titi.
Good morning, Mr. Bote, and thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Now the verdict on the trial of Mohamed Jabate, so-called Jungle Jabba, has been handed down. What can you tell us about the verdict itself?
Well, Mohamed Jabate was found guilty by the jury on 4 counts, 2 counts perjury, and 2 counts of immigration fraud.
Those are all related to the forms he filled out in the United States. Was there anything that have to do with his role in the Liberian Civil War?
Well, it had nothing to do with what he did in the Liberian Civil War, but everything was about the forms he filled out and his verbal admittance to swearing on the oath that whatever he said on the form was the truth and nothing but the truth. But for the American government to prove that Mohamed Jabate, a.k.a. Jungle Jabba, lied on the oath, they had to go back to Liberia and bring back witnesses to testify that he indeed was a part of the Liberian Civil War, that he raped, he murdered, he committed all sort of atrocities. So that was why victims from the war were brought to testify against their defendant.
Was Mr. Jabate himself in a courtroom and any reaction, say, from him, from his family members or his lawyers?
Throughout the 3 weeks of the trial, Mohamed Jabate was always in court every day. For the last 2 days, his family members have been in court, filling 2 of the courtrooms because obviously they couldn't fill 1, so they had an additional courtroom on the 16th floor where you could go and witness the trial on a video stream. 1 or 2 of them were like very angry about the verdict and tried to talk after the verdict was announced.
We learned during the trial that no witnesses from Liberia testify on his behalf. Instead, he had witnesses here in the United States. How effective do you think that strategy was?
Well, I don't know how effective it was because obviously he got a guilty verdict today. We heard earlier on in the trial that at least four persons would have testified from the American embassy via satellite here. But then a day to that, we heard from the judge that the defense lawyer said those people are not going to testify. And he brought up 10 persons who were character witnesses.
You were in Philadelphia now for 2 weeks or so or more. What is the feeling among Liberians in the Philadelphia area?
There's been a mixed reaction from Liberians here in the diaspora, especially those who come from the tribe of Mohamed Jabate, kind of feeling that, you know, there is no need for this because this guy, it's been more than 20 years since he left Liberia and he has moved on with his life. He's a good man here now, so we don't think that should happen. There are some who believe that justice is being served. There are so many people who committed atrocities, mayhem on people in Liberia, and they're finding other places to go and hide. And so this case could serve as a reawakening for those who have done bad things to people during the war.
What's next now for Mr. Jabate? Do you know when the sentencing phase of the case will take place?
We actually don't know because we talked to government lawyers today who told us that it could happen in a matter of months.
So in the meantime, Mohamed Jabate is going to be what, sent to prison or what?
Absolutely, because I heard the judge say to the marshals that they should take him back to prison.
Titi Jibro, thank you very much. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you so much, sir.
That's Liberian journalist Titi Jibro in the U.S. city of Philadelphia, where she's been covering the trial of former Liberian warlord Mohamed Jabate. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 19th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Burundi has denied revelations in the Panama Papers that President Pierre Nkurunziza diverted money from Burundi to offshore companies. Moses Javier Rimana has the story from Bujumbura.
The Panama Papers that reveals documents containing financial information about wealthy individuals and public officials that had previously kept private has now revealed that Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza took advantage of the political crisis in the country to enrich himself illegally. According to the Panama Papers, helped by a group of African journalists, the team is said to have discovered about Burundi's president holding hundreds of millions of dollars on accounts abroad. However, Jean-Claude Carrera, President Pierre Nkurunziza's spokesman, snubbed the report.
Overall, it should be noted that the Panama Papers report is nothing but loads of rubbish. It's another episode that feeds into the diabolical dynamics aimed at sabotaging the republican institutions of Burundi through a campaign of slander, calumny, and a defamation as simple as that.
The Burundi opposition leader and the deputy speaker of the parliament, Agathon Rwasa, said that the revelation comes with no surprise, blaming the African leaders as the main reason to overstay in power.
This is likely a common picture of what African leaders are. And this is one of the root causes of them changing the constitutions to make sure that they are in power for life. It means that there is lack of governance. There is no good, there is no bad, there is no governance at all.
Burundi government said that the revelation was nothing but to tarnish the government's image. Nkurunziza's spokesman, Jean-Claude Carrera, said that the report targeted mostly Africans.
Well, it's another episode which feeds into a campaign to slander the institutions, the leaders of Burundi, and also now associating the president of Burundi and some Burundian leaders with African presidents like Jacob Zuma pay for the support in favor of Burundi. You know, about the resolution filed at the Human Rights Council session in Geneva.
Burundi is currently in an economic crisis as inflation rate was last recorded this year at 13%. According to the World Bank, the poverty rate is expected to pass 70%. Currently, fuel shortage have hit the country for almost a month now, as the country is facing foreign currency shortage, according to the importers. Moses Javier Imana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Remittances from overseas diaspora constitute a vital part of the economy of many developing nations, now more so than Somalia, where the inflows add up to more than foreign aid and investment combined. But analysts warn the industry is poorly understood by regulators and banks, putting the welfare of millions of people at risk. As Henry Richwell reports, there are hopes new technology will broaden the market and lower fees.
Every month, Fatma Ahmed sends $200 of the earnings she makes in London to her family in Somalia.
It's for daily life, for rent, for buying the grocery things and to live over there, because actually in Somalia that much we don't have.
The 2 million Somalis living overseas send an estimated $1.3 billion back home every year. With no formal banking system in Somalia, most of the diaspora use remittance services. Abdirashid Diwale is CEO of Dahab Shiel, one of Africa's biggest remittance services.
Now it's so instant, where we have the latest technology with the internet, secure channels that we can use to send money back home, or we use mobiles and other means of, you know, smartphone and technology, where it will help us to deliver money quickly, but also less costly. Technology is supporting us also with a compliance issue.
Remittance companies still rely on global banks to route the money. Those banks must comply with regulations on money laundering and the financing of crime and terrorism. Citing those concerns, many have chosen to withdraw from the market, unnecessarily, says remittance industry expert Laura Hammond of London's School of Oriental and African Studies.
Very often it's not based on any kind of empirical evidence that shows that money is going into the wrong hands. The fear is just, you know, Somalia, there's a conflict in Somalia, there's the Al-Shabaab movement, and so there's a problem in a sense, a real precarious nature of the Somali remittance industry.
The industry got a high-profile boost last month as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation donated $1 million using the remittance firm Dahab Shiel, along with mobile phone companies Somtel and eDahab, with the money transferred live to 1,000 families suffering the drought in Somalia. Former US President Barack Obama also attended. The technology is moving fast, but the cooperation of the global banking system remains key, and the remittance industry wants regulators to do more to support this lifeline. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The United Nations Children's Fund says a joint program has helped reunite at least 5,000 children with their families since the South Sudan conflict broke out in late 2013. Tim Irwin, UNICEF's chief of communication in South Sudan, says reuniting thousands of children with their family members is a significant achievement, but he says much more work needs to be done.
It is a big number, and I think it's a significant accomplishment, and obviously that means that there are 5,000 children who are with their families or their caregivers. There are 5,000 families that are intact that were separated before. So it's a big achievement, and everyone involved in it is proud. And obviously, the young man himself, who was separated from his mother for 4 years, who is our 5,000th reunion, is delighted. But it's important to remember that there are 16,000 children who have been registered as being separated from their parents or caregivers. So we've reunited 5,000, that's great, but that means that there are still around 11,000 children who are separated from their families. So, you know, there's much, much more work that needs to be done.
Talk to us about the Family Tracing and Reunification Program. What is it? How does it work?
Well, it's extremely important, as you can imagine. I mean, since 2013, as I said, we've had about 16,000 registered with us. Almost certainly there are more children than those who are registered with us who have become separated from their families. And generally, you know, they become separated when their village or their town becomes caught up in the fighting and people flee for their lives. And often family, parents and children become separated. So it's one of the core areas that we work in with our partners, such as Save the Children, who work with us very closely on what we call family tracing and reunification. It's a very time-consuming process, as you can imagine. I mean, infrastructure in South Sudan is extremely basic. There's no landline system. There's only limited cellular system, very few paved roads. So just getting the information out, and that's basically how the process starts. We speak with the child or we speak with the parent who tells us about their missing parent or their missing child, where they last saw them. And then we begin the process of working with the communities. There's a system of about six what we call protection of civilian sites. They're run by the UN here in South Sudan, and therefore displaced people who have been displaced by the fighting from their homes and are too afraid to return. There's around 200,000 people living in those camps, and obviously circulating information within a camp environment is less difficult than it would be, you know, trying to trace people who have maybe fled to the bush, who have fled to other towns. So it's very time consuming, it's very costly, but you know, the rewards are fantastic.
That was Tim Irwin, Chief of Communications for UNICEF in South Sudan. He was speaking to IMBO from Juba. Senegal has made significant advances in its healthcare system when it comes to pain medications and palliative care, according to a Human Rights Watch report released this week. In the past 5 years, the country has boosted its national estimate for morphine from just over 1,100 grams to more than 40,000 grams. Human Rights Watch's Health and Human Rights Director, Deoderic Loma, talks to Ricky Stryak about how the progress has happened.
The largest cancer unit for adults at Dantec Hospital in Dakar has hired a palliative care specialist, and that's a first in Senegal, and was really a really necessary step because there are so many patients with cancer who are stage three, stage four, who can't really benefit from any curative treatment anymore, and often suffer from, you know, from very severe pain and need a physician who can appropriately address that pain. The Ministry of Health has taken a number of steps in order to improve access to end-of-life care services. They are now making sure that morphine is available through kind of their own supply system, in, so that hospitals don't have to buy the medication individually anymore. The ministry has changed the regulations around the prescribing of medications like morphine so that patients don't have to come back to the hospital every week in order to get a new prescription.
Why was palliative care, why were basically pain medications hard to come by or not prescribed in the dosage that perhaps they should have been? Is there an abuse problem, or is it just a matter of funds or attention to this issue?
There really were a number of reasons. One is, if you look at the health situation in Senegal, it's a country that only recently has seen significant gains in life expectancy and reductions in deaths from infectious diseases. And so the issue of people living longer and developing more chronic illnesses is a relatively new one for the country. And so in a way, a problem that has existed for a long time in, you know, kind of more middle and high income countries has made an entry in countries like Senegal, where healthcare systems weren't really set up to deal with patients with chronic and life-threatening illnesses, and so it has required something of a shift in the way the healthcare system deals with kind of population health needs. So that's one. And related to that, most physicians and other healthcare staff in Senegal simply did not have any kind of training in the use of medications like morphine in, you know, kind of the provision of care for patients with chronic life-threatening illnesses.
That was Human Rights Watch's Health and Human Rights Director, Deoderic Loma, who was speaking to Ricky Stryak from New York. And that is it for this Thursday, October 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Button in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there.
VOA.
On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. and our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.